The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Gaitis, Judge Smith, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Theodora Gaitis presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, November 16th, 2023, and we have six cases on our calendar. Three of those cases are scheduled for oral argument via the Zoom platform. And I see that we have all of our counsel present for our first case. So I'm going to go ahead and call that case, and then I'll give you a few more specific instructions before we hear your arguments. The first case on our calendar is A231260 in the matter of the civil commitment of Peter Allen. And welcome, counsel. We are eager to hear your arguments this morning. Just a few housekeeping things before we get started. I just want to note that the appellant will have 15 minutes to present argument, and then it is my understanding that the attorneys for respondents will be splitting their time this morning with 10 minutes for counsel for the commissioner and 10 minutes for counsel from Otter Tail County, or 5 minutes rather, excuse me. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Great, thank you. And since we're talking about time, I just want to make sure, and you can just nod your heads, that all of the attorneys can see the clock that is on the screen. Yes? Okay. That will be counting down your time. Just a couple other notes. We are making an audio recording of the arguments today, and in order to make sure that audio recording is really clear, I ask that you please identify yourself and the party you're representing before you begin your arguments. And then finally, just make sure that you mute yourself when you're not the lawyer who is talking, again, to make sure that audio recording is good. That recording will be available on our website shortly as well. That concludes my opening remarks. I will now hear from the attorneys. We'll begin with counsel for appellant. You will have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Jill Avery. I'm with Templeman Law, and we represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Peter Allen. Mr. Allen is appealing the commitment appeal panel's order granting respondent's motion to dismiss his petition for provisional discharge and discharge because Mr. Allen did put forth a prima facie case for both of these reliefs in his part one hearing, and that he put forth sufficient competent evidence that if proven entitled him to provisional discharge and discharge. In a part one hearing, the burden on Mr. Allen was one of production and not of persuasion. The commitment appeal panel could only look to Mr. Allen's exhibits, and they had to view them in a light most favorable to Mr. Allen. The commitment appeal panel was not to weigh the evidence because doing so would elevate his burden from one of production to one of persuasion. And then the commitment appeal panel is not to consider the initial commitment, but only look to the reduction in custody criteria. In granting respondent's motion, however, the commitment appeal panel did all of these things. For example, they looked at the respondent's evidence when they stated Dr. Muggy did not address narcissistic personality disorder in her testimony that was part of respondent's exhibits. They wrongly weighed Dr. Muggy's opinion by saying it was based on appellant's self-report and limited records in light of his limited participation in treatment. Credibility is not to be considered in the burden of production. They wrongly considered his initial commitment in saying that he must be dangerous because of actions he took 25 years ago. And they invented new evidence when they stated that Mr. Allen suffered from pedophilia when there's nothing in the record at any time that Mr. Allen suffered from pedophilia. They did not look at the evidence in a light most favorable to Mr. Allen when they claimed he had a complete lack of participation in treatment, when Dr. Muggy, Dr. Berg, and Mr. Allen all testified that he had participated in treatment for for years, and that treatment was sex offender treatment. The respondent followed suit and in their briefs inserted words into Dr. Muggy's opinions where they didn't exist and took things out of context. For example, the commissioner states in her brief that Dr. Muggy opined that Mr. Allen had remaining treatment needs regarding sexual interests. Dr. Muggy instead reported that that Mr. Allen's treatment needs were relational and interpersonal as opposed to sexual interest. Dr. Muggy also never opined that Mr. Allen suffered from antisocial personality burnout, but instead that he was experiencing that phenomenon, and that's a beneficial thing. In addition, the commissioner wrongly stated that Mr. Allen had a diagnosis of antisocial personality in the past, which he did not.
Ms. Avery, I'd like to ask you a few questions about the provisional discharge issue, sure. Which it seems to me was the type of discharge that Dr. Muggy was supportive of. I'm wondering whether a Minnesota court or entity has the authority to order a federal prison to provide sex offender treatment, which seemed to be sort of a condition of Dr. Muggy's opinion that provisional discharge would be appropriate.
I'm sorry, you're cutting out a little bit. Could you repeat? You're cutting out.
Yeah, you cut out a little bit as well. And I apologize for that. So I'm wondering whether a Minnesota court or, you know, entity has the authority to require the federal prisons to provide sex offender treatment to someone in federal custody.
Well, I don't think anybody has that ability to order them to do so. But Mr. Allen did write his provisional discharge plan in a manner that does require him to participate. And if he does not, whether they don't allow him to, he can be immediately revoked. And in his past CAP hearing it was AP 15, I think it's cited in the respondents brief. They did not grant him a discharge saying that, you know, there was no parameters that would require him to participate. And he did write his provisional discharge plan in a manner that requires him to go to federal prison right as soon as he's ready to be leaving the secure facility, and that it's on him to participate in sex offender treatment. Otherwise,
was sex offender treatment ordered as part of the federal sentence, either at the outset or in response to the probation violation?
No, it was not. And his probation violation simply was he was placed in the halfway house in the community after he served his 6 years or his term. He was released on, he received an early release for good behavior. He was technically violated because he received a sex offender designation. So he was no longer able to live in that halfway house with that designation. So there was nothing he did. It was just a technical violation that then required him to serve 2 more years. So he tried to take care of that that concern that he would not participate in sex offender treatment. He's willing and able to do that. And again, they can revoke him immediately. If he does not get in on his own, he has to be the one responsible to take care of that.
I have a follow-up question on what Judge Gaetis just asked. So as I understand the statute and the factors that the panel had to consider, one of the issues is whether the petitioner's course of treatment and present mental status indicate there's no longer a need for treatment and supervision in the committed person's treatment setting. And my understanding of Dr. Muggy's testimony was that she said petitioner no longer needs treatment and supervision in his current setting at MSOP if, and then she provided two conditions, if, or on the condition that petitioner be transferred to a secure federal prison upon release and be required to participate in sex offense specific treatment while in federal prison. Sorry. To me, I don't read anything in the statutory factors to say that we can allow for this conditional conditional opinion to carry the day. So could you please speak to that? Explain to me why we shouldn't consider Dr. Muggy's conditional opinion as insufficient to establish that first factor.
Mr. Allen put forth this provisional discharge plan to the SRB initially. And as you know from the statute, that only the terms and conditions that were put forth to the SRB can be considered by the commitment appeal panel. So the only provisional discharge plan that the panel could consider is the one that he put forth, which is amended to say that he will go to federal prison and participate in federal sex offender treatment. And that is what was presented to Dr. Muggy to make
that
her opinion.
That goes to the second factor, Ms. Avery. That talks about whether the conditions of the provisional discharge plan would provide the reasonable degree of protection, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I'm specifically wanting to know about the first factor. It seems to me that that is completely separate.
Okay, so can you re-explain your question on the first factor?
Certainly. There has to be a consideration of whether his course of treatment and present mental status indicate there's no longer a need for treatment and supervision in the current treatment setting, which is at MSAP. And her opinion was conditional. Her opinion said he no longer needs treatment and supervision in the current setting if petitioner is transferred to a secure federal provision, and if he is required to participate in sex offense specific treatment. So the fact that her opinion was conditional seems to not meet the requirement that we look at when we look at that first factor.
Well, Mr. Allen is committed to the secure facility, which is a prison-like setting. And Dr. Muggy did opine that he meets the requirements for CPS, which is a reduced less secure facility. It's a residential type facility without locks on the doors. And that was enough. Again, her opinion was always based on what was presented to her. And she had noted that he is not a security risk. He goes to treatment willingly. He has a very low risk of dangerousness, sexual recidivism. He's participated in treatment for years, and that he has already obtained the optimum dosage. But this part would ensure any concerns that the prior commitment appeal panel had, that he did not have sufficient treatment. Her optimal dosage recommendation was 100 to 149 hours, which he has surpassed even before the hearings. But her concern was just to make sure that the court was comfortable that he would have sufficient treatment before he was put into the community. She opined that more than that, treatment can actually have a detrimental effect. And she also talked about, you know, his participation in treatment, his extensive protective factors. He's 25 years since his offenses happened, and there's been no behaviors that would indicate that he has any risk of recidivism.
It seems to me that we're looking at a bit of a unique situation here in terms of the fact that he has this federal sentence that he has to go serve, and that it's going to occur subsequent to whenever he is released from MSAP. So, you know, can you speak to that issue a bit here? I'm not sure that we're supposed to consider that aspect of this. I think we just look at what the statutes require, regardless of whether someone has an additional sentence to serve elsewhere.
And I agree with that. And I think if you look at the considerations of provisional discharge, is does he need treatment and supervision in a prison-like sentence? And the answer to that is no, he does not. He goes to treatment. So if you're looking beyond that and saying that there's parameters after, it does not talk about, the statute just does not talk about that. It is whether he needs it in his present setting, which he clearly does not. And the second factor was whether the provisional discharge factor gives the public sufficient protection, which it would, based on him having two more years in prison with treatment and then into the community.
Okay. And just a moment ago, you said that Dr. Muggy said that he does not need treatment in a prison-like setting. I'm not trying to catch you in any way. I'm just trying to understand what it is that Dr. Muggy actually opined to. And it seems that actually she did opined that he needs to be transferred to a secure prison to continue this treatment because of the two conditions that she mentioned.
Well, again, that was based on her reading the SRB provisional discharge plan that was provided to her and asking that that was sufficient. So that's what she was asked to comment on and opine to, because that's all that the CAP can do. They cannot do it based on anything else, because that's all that was presented to this, to the SRB.
Okay, thank you.
Did Dr. Muggy support full discharge? DHS said that Dr. Muggy testified that the evidence was insufficient to conclude that Mr. Allen was no longer dangerous to the public and no longer in need of treatment and supervision. And I'm just wondering if that's an accurate characterization of her testimony in your view.
Well, and I think her testimony was that she still thinks he has treatment needs in interpersonal and relational. And her opinion relative to this, to the statutory factors, was that he did not meet all of those things because he had those remaining treatment needs. But in effect, her testimony really was that he met the statutory criteria, because the statutory criteria is that he would need treatment for a sexual disorder or mental disorder, not just interpersonal or relational. So I think in effect she did opine to that, but also constitutional considerations.
So just to be clear, she did opine that full discharge was appropriate, you know, given the statutory factors?
I believe she did, because her testimony was limited to not needing sexual treatment, but needing interpersonal and relational. And when you look at, she testified that he does not have any personality or sexual disorders, and that means he has no treatment needs in that area. Additionally, the constitutional criteria is whether a person has a mental illness or sexual disorder and is dangerous. And clearly he is not dangerous. He has a very, very low static score, sexual recidivism rate of 1-2%, extensive protective factors, aging, time in the community after he was intervened on for over two years without reoffending. He's sober. He's been sober for 25 years. And there's no mental illness. So both of those factors would lead you to believe that the constitutional aspects have been met, as well as the...
Can you speak to the recidivism risk a little bit? I was thinking about, statistically speaking, 1-2% doesn't sound like a lot. My understanding is that she put the number at 1.6. When compared to the general population, it was, I think the recidivism or possibility that someone would commit another act would be like 0.4. So 1.6 is actually four times as high as that, as the other statistics. So don't we need to look at it from that perspective, as opposed to just saying, well, 1.6 sounds like a small number compared to 100%.
No, and actually, you know, the 0.4% is not a recidivism rate, but a new offense rate for somebody that's a male non-offender. 1% to 2% is extremely low. And when you couple that on with treatment participation, which reduces that number by 30%, the extensive amount of protective factors Mr. Allen has. In the couple of cases we cited, Mr. Swedeen had a static rate of 3%, and Fugleseth was in the low teens, and both of those were considered low risk factors. So you look at the record as a whole, no bad behavior in 25 years. And I understand he's been in a controlled environment for some of those years, but 2 years he was in the community. He is sober for 25 years. And these things are available to them in a controlled environment. There is drugs, there is alcohol, there is female staff that engage in relationships with clients. There's pornography, and he's participated in none of that. And he's very supportive to his peers. He teaches the native language. He's very spiritual. So he does all the things that he's supposed to do, and he's engaging in treatment, and he's a very active and active participant in that.
Thank you very much, Ms. Avery. Your time is up. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal argument, however. Thanks. And now we will turn things over to the attorneys representing the respondents. The clock is set for Respondent Commissioner of Human Services. You may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Brandon Basie, I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. The Clement Appeal Panel's order dismissing Mr. Allen's petition for a reduction in custody should be affirmed for three primary reasons. First, provisional discharge to federal prison is neither a reduction in custody, nor is federal prison open society. Second, Mr. Allen's plan for provisional discharge is based on speculation and conjecture. There is no evidence in the record that Mr. Allen will be detained by the federal government if he's released. There's no evidence in the record that Mr. Allen will be put in a federal prison that has a sex offender treatment program. And there's no evidence in the record that Mr. Allen will actually be accepted to said program, even if he's in a facility where that program exists. And third, Your Honors, with respect to full discharge, Mr. Allen's own retained expert testified that he was not appropriate for full discharge from his civil commitment. Based on the record, the CAP correctly dismissed Mr. Allen's petition for a reduction in custody. One thing I would like to just start with, based on some of the questions from Your Honors, Dr. Muggy was clear under cross-examination that her opinion was not simply regarding going to federal prison was not simply because that's what the plan was that was presented to her. She was asked, I just want to, this was on page 66 of the transcript from the first hearing. I just want to clarify that your support is contingent on him completing sex offender treatment in the federal prison, right? Answer, yes. So her opinion was contingent on him completing sex offender treatment. Dr. Muggy also stated that, contrary to the arguments put forth by Mr. Allen, that he hasn't had a sufficient dosage of treatment and that she testified that the treatment that he would get in federal prison if he's there would then be a sufficient dosage for him at that point. Third, Your Honor, I think Judge Wheelock had some questions about treatment and whether he needed treatment in his current setting or another setting and what the testimony was regarding that. To be clear, the statute requires there a consideration of whether he no longer needs treatment in his current setting. The question is not whether he could get treatment, the same treatment in another setting, or whether he believes another setting could provide adequate treatment for him. During the hearing on page 61 of the transcript, she was asked whether the treatment that she opines that he could get in the federal program could be completed at MSOP. She stated yes. So the issue or the evidence here shows that it's not that Mr. Allen can only get the treatment that he needs at federal prison. It's just that that's a location where Mr. Allen would like to go. And that's simply not what the statute permits.
Counsel, may I ask a question about the reduction? Your argument regarding that, can a person committed to MSOP ever get a provisional discharge if they have an outstanding federal sentence that they need to serve, even if they could otherwise prove it if they didn't have such sentence, prove up their case?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that there could be a situation that exists if an individual has a federal detainer that they would have to serve after they're out of MSOP. You can imagine a situation where an individual would progress in treatment sufficient to a point where there is evidence that the person is able to adjust successfully to the community, or they no longer need treatment in their current setting. I think the garden variety case that we see of provisional discharge are individuals going to a group home or to a halfway house out of MSOP. And you can imagine a situation where you have an individual who has reduced their risk of harm and their treatment needs to a point where they could do outpatient treatment in a group home. And the fact that there's a federal detainer isn't really part of the analysis of whether there's a provisional discharge location. That's just not the evidence we have in this case.
Is that because the treatment in federal prison was considered a condition in the evaluation of it, of provisional discharge, or that whether he's you know, qualified, eligible for provisional discharge?
Correct. The evidence we have is from an individual, Dr. Muggy, who opined that the reason why she was supporting discharge is because he would be going to federal prison where he would be required to participate in that sex offender treatment program. And if he satisfactorily completes that program, then her opinion was then he could progress to a community placement. But the statute is couched in terms of present tense. It's whether the person is capable of making an acceptable adjustment to open society, not will he be able to. And this, the evidence that we have in front of the CAP, and the reason why the CAP's order is correct on provisional discharge, at best, the evidence that Mr. Allen presented was, if he is released, and if the Federal Bureau of Prisons detains him, and if they place him in a facility that offers sex offender treatment, and if he's accepted into that program, and if he satisfactorily completes that program, then Mr. Allen can adjust successfully to the community. And that's just simply not what the statute
requires. Wouldn't you agree that the statute and the circumstances here are just kind of an awkward fit? Because, you know, given the federal detainer and the requirement that he serve an additional 2 years, the statute is requiring that it be proven that he, you know, be able to adjust to an open society. And that's just simply not a reality, given the federal sentence that he's facing. So I'm just wondering, you know, given that awkward fit, what is a court supposed to do in these circumstances?
Well, Judge Gaitis, I think that to be candid, the statute isn't asking whether the person will be able to adjust to the community once they're on provisional discharge. The question is, has the person reached a point in treatment today at the time of his hearing that he can adjust to the community? So there can be a person, I'm sure there are people who would be able to show that they could adjust to the community. And the fact that they have a federal detainer on them is really of no relevance to the question of whether they could adjust to the community at that point in treatment. I agree that if there was an individual who had a federal detainer who could show that they would be set, they could adjust to the community and would be appropriate for a group home on other circumstances, I agree that it would be kind of awkward and MSOP would have to probably work with the Federal Bureau of Prisons to come up with a provisional discharge plan that would take into account being detained in federal prison and how they would get him back. And I guess that's another issue is we don't know. There was no evidence presented at the hearing from any representative of the Bureau of Prisons. There's no evidence indicating that the Bureau of Prisons would actually pick him up. The detainer says that once he's no longer in the custody of the commissioner, and the commissioner with individuals who are on provisional discharge is overseeing their provisional discharge, it's unclear whether the Bureau of Prisons would determine that provisional discharge is actually something that would lead to the detainer. So these are all hypothetical and speculative issues that just no evidence was presented. So based on the plan that was presented and the evidence we have, it just does not support provisional discharge under the statute.
So if you had a person, counsel, and that's in the situation we just described where they have a detainer, but they otherwise could have proved the standards for provisional discharge. But some of those include, you know, the conditions that are necessary to protect the public. And I guess your argument, well, we don't know whether those would actually take place if they have a detainer. Is it realistic to think that the federal, like at this stage, that there would be testimony even before a determination that he'd get out, that they come and say, yes, we have this, this, and this for them? And why doesn't the condition that he could be revoked, it could be revoked if they're not provided, just satisfy that need? Otherwise, it seems to strand people. That's the concern. Did they get stranded in MSOP because you can't figure out for sure right now what the would happen in the federal prison?
To answer your second part of the question on revocation, I don't know what authority the commissioner would have to tell a federal prison that they have to release custody of Mr. Allen back to the custody of the commissioner. If Mr. Allen is in a federal prison in Massachusetts, I'm not sure what, like, that. I don't think that the commissioner could order the Bureau of Prisons to give custody back to her. But to answer...
Oh, and I actually had that question from Ms. Avery, too. I wondered what that meant. Does it mean at the close of the federal detention that the MSOP regains custody, or not during it, you know?
I guess I'm not sure, but I also don't know, you know, the Bureau of Prisons doesn't have any interest in sending Mr. Allen back. If he's in Massachusetts and he's let out the front door of Massachusetts federal prison because his sentence is over, you know, I don't think there's any evidence in the record regarding how an individual would be picked up at that point. And in fact, the evidence showed that MSOP didn't know either. I see that I'm out of time. I could respond, Judge Smith, to the beginning part of your question, but I don't want to go over time, given that I know my co-counsel has some things he'd like to tell the court as well. But thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument. And we'll turn to your co-counsel now. Good morning. You will have 5 minutes for your argument.
Thank you. My name is Ben Olson. I'm an assistant Otter Tail County attorney. I represent Otter Tail County, the county of commitment. We are here asking the court to affirm the CAP's decision to dismiss Mr. Allen's petition for provisional discharge and discharge for failure to state a prima facie case. Just want to note at the outset that we support all of the arguments that the commissioner has made, both in its briefing and here today. I don't want to repeat those, given the limited time that we have. I think I want to just highlight a few issues relating to the discharge criteria. Mr. Allen's argument is that Dr. Muggy did not diagnose him with any specific disorder, and therefore he has no treatment needs, and there is no reason to supervise him. And I think that position ignores both the legal standard that we're required to apply and reality. The commissioner cites case law in its briefing that recognizes that clinical definitions of diagnoses and legal criteria for commitment are different. They serve different purposes, and Dr. Muggy expounded on that in her testimony. She talked about how clinical diagnoses are designed to guide providers treating their patients. They're not designed to determine whether someone should be indeterminately civilly committed because of their pattern of sexually offending on individuals in the community.
Mr. Olson, would you agree, however, that the panel clearly erred in noting multiple times in its order that the diagnosis was one of pedophilia?
There is nothing in the record to support that. But I think what's important in that context, and really in the context of all of the other allegations of error that Mr. Allen is making, is the standard of review. The CAP doesn't make factual findings at a first stage hearing. The CAP summarizes the evidence and determines whether what's been presented creates a genuine issue of fact. The question for this court is whether the evidence, it's the same exact question, and it's a de novo review. And so the court can set that, this court can set that sentence in the order aside and disregard it. And if it does that, it still can support the ultimate determination to dismiss the petition because there is no genuine issue of fact as to discharge. The question is whether there's a nexus between the reason for the original commitment and the need for continued confinement. And when you look at the case through that lens, you do have to look at the offending behavior. You do have to recognize that Mr. Allen has five victims, that he intentionally drugged them before he offended against them when they were unable to consent, because that tells us what kind of treatment and what kind of things need to happen before he can make an acceptable adjustment to society. And the fact, or the reality, is that he's never taken accountability for that behavior. He expresses remorse. He acknowledges that he did these things, but that's a far cry from saying that he intentionally did them. He's still hiding behind this curtain that Ambien is the cause, and he is the victim of that drug, not that he did these things. The other thing that I think is just as important is the fact that he didn't fully engage in treatment until about 18 months ago. And that's the concern, is that even his own expert witness would not support a plan that would involve him going back to the community with no more treatment requirements and no more supervision. And on that kind of record, I don't see how there could be a genuine issue of fact. And that is why the CAP was had authority to dismiss the petition. I think just with my limited time here, I would like to kind of address the question. Well, doesn't this put Mr. Allen in a predicament? Isn't this an awkward fit because of what is being asked of him on his federal sentence? I agree it is, but whose burden is that to bear? Is it the public's by granting this plan that's based on speculation and conjecture? I don't think so. I think the person that has to bear that reality is Mr. Allen, because it's his conduct that led him into this situation. I only have 20 seconds left. I don't think that's enough time to make any more points, so I'll just leave it at that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your argument. And now we will go back to Ms. Avery. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I first want to talk about the federal authority to retake Mr. Allen or to turn him over afterward. There is a case, Inri Ivey, that there was a person who was a commitment petition was placed on. He was returning from Germany and landed in New York, and Minnesota arranged for federal authorities to apprehend him there as he got off the plane and escort him back to Minnesota. So I do think there is a reach of federal authority to take him into custody wherever he is for MSOP. But again, there's no evidence where he's going to be placed, and highly likely he would be placed somewhere in Minnesota when he did his original sentence. He was in a low security prison. Now it's just a technical violation. He most likely would be in a federal camp, the minimal security, where it's more residential. I can't tell you that though. And it's not based on speculation and conjecture, because if he's not placed in an appropriate federal prison with and engages in treatment, he can be revoked. And he wrote it that way because he wanted everybody to be sure that he was participating.
And what happens, Ms. Avery, can you respond to what happens if he is revoked?
Then he goes back to the secure treatment facility.
And when? I think that the response was, how do they get him back out of federal prison, or how do they ensure that he returns if he's released from federal prison at the close?
Well, in the Ivy case, they were able to escort, the commissioner was able to escort, or whoever it was, able to escort him back from New York, this person, back from New York to be civilly committed. So there is that reach. I also wanted to talk about the whether Mr. Allen prefers this treatment or not. That's not a statutory consideration. It shouldn't be used for him, and it shouldn't be used against him. But I'm not sure if one of the cases I cited in my brief for another reason, the Rudd v. Johnston, talks about the lack of staffing at MSOP and how that affects these clients at MSOP. So people are waiting years to get from the secure perimeter to CPS because of staffing problems. And in the secure perimeter right now, they've been told that there's no more treatment for 2 weeks because staffing problems, the clinicians are overworked and they have to catch up on their paperwork. And then after that, their treatment is going to be cut in half. They're going to get 2 hours of treatment a week of their group therapy. That is a consideration that, you know, let's make this a win-win situation where he can get better treatment in the federal prison. Again, it's not a statutory criteria, but it's the truth of the situation right now at MSOP. These facilities are in, the one he's at is in Moose Lake. It's a very small community. You've got hundreds of men there that need clinicians, and they just can't handle the lack of staffing. I wanted to just talk briefly about, his diagnosis of this other specified criteria. Things do change. I mean, people can change from their original diagnosis just by aging, just by time in treatment, different factors. It's not anything, treatment is not the only thing that changes a person's diagnosis. And if you look at the DSM-4, back in those days, it was a paraphilia or a personality disorder not otherwise specified, but they talked about it being a paraphilia. or personality disorder. And that changed. The DSM-5 now talks about other specified personality disorders or paraphilias, that it's a reason to say why a person doesn't meet the criteria. There's no diagnostic criteria listed in the DSM-5 for other specified personality disorder or other specified paraphilic disorder, nothing. So how do clinicians decide that fits? And if you Google even those two terms in general, you will not find other specified paraphilia or other specified personality disorder. They're not listed as a diagnosis in the DSM-5, which is the current governing document. If that's all you have, I don't have anything further.
I see no other questions. Thank you all so much for your arguments this morning, which were very helpful. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will issue our decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you. And that concludes our first argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.